This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Dust Tracks on a Road by Zora Neale Hurston. Read by Bonnie Turpin. Chapter 1. My Birthplace. Like the dead-seeming cold rocks, I have memories within that came out of the material that went to make me. Time and place have had their say. So you will have to know something about the time and place where I came from in order that you may interpret the incidents and directions of my life. I was born in a Negro town. I do not mean by that the black backside of an average town. Eatonville, Florida is, and was, at the time of my birth, a pure Negro town. Charter, mayor, council, town marshal and all. It was not the first Negro community in America, but it was the first to be incorporated. The first attempt at organized self-government on the part of Negroes in America. Eatonville is what you might call hitting a straight lick with a crooked stick. The town was not in the original plan. It is a byproduct of something else. It all started with three white men on a ship off the coast of Brazil. They had been officers in the Union Army. When the bitter war had ended in victory for their side, they had set out for South America. Perhaps the post-war distress made their native homes depressing. Perhaps it was just that they were young, and it was hard for them to return to the monotony of everyday being after the excitement of military life. And they, as numerous other young men, set out to find new frontiers. But they never landed in Brazil. Talking together on the ship, these three decided to return to the United States and try their fortunes in the unsettled country of South Florida. No doubt the same thing which had moved them to go to Brazil caused them to choose South Florida. This had been dark and bloody country since the mid-1700s. Spanish, French, English, Indian, and American blood had been bountifully shed. The last great struggle was between the resentful Indians and the white planters of Georgia, Alabama, and South Carolina. The strong and powerful Cherokees, aided by the conglomerate Seminoles, raided the plantations and carried off Negro slaves into the Spanish-held Florida. Ostensibly, they were carried off to be slaves to the Indians, but in reality, the Negro men were used to swell the ranks of the Indian fighters against the white plantation owners. During lulls in the long struggle, treaties were signed but invariably broken. The sore point of returning escaped Negroes could not be settled satisfactorily to either side. Who was an Indian and who was a Negro? The whites contended all who had Negro blood. The Indians contended all who spoke their language belonged to the tribe. Since it was an easy matter to teach a slave to speak enough of the language to pass in a short time, the question could never be settled. So the wars went on. The names of Oglethorpe, Clinch, and Andrew Jackson are well known on the white side of the struggle. For the Indians, Micanopy, Billy Bowlegs, and Osceola. The noble Osceola was only a sub-chief, but he came to be recognized by both sides as the ablest of them all. Had he not been captured by treachery, the struggle would have lasted much longer than it did. With an offer of friendship and a new rifle, some say a beautiful sword, he was lured to the fort 7 miles outside of St. Augustine and captured. He was confined in somber Fort Marion that still stands in that city, escaped, was recaptured, and died miserably in the prison of a fort in Beaufort, South Carolina. Without his leadership, the Indian cause collapsed. The Cherokees and most of the Seminoles, with their Negro adherents, were moved west. The beaten Indians were moved to what is now Oklahoma. It was far from the then settlements of the whites. And then, too, there seemed to be nothing there that white people wanted. So it was a good place for Indians. The wilds of Florida heard no more clash of battle among men. The sensuous world whirled on in the arms of ether for a generation or so. Time made and marred some men. So into this original hush came the three frontier seekers who had been so intrigued by its prospects that they had turned back after actually arriving at the coast of Brazil without landing. These young men were no poor refuge-seeking wayfarers. They were educated men of family and wealth. The shores of Lake Maitland were beautiful, so they chose the northern end and settled. There one of the old forts built against the Indians had stood. It had been commanded by Colonel Maitland, so the lake and the community took their names in memory of him. It was Mosquito County then, and the name was just. It is Orange County now, for equally good reason. The men persuaded other friends in the north to join them, and the town of Maitland began to be in a great rush. Negroes were found to do the clearing. There was the continuous roar of the crashing of ancient giants of the lush woods, of axes, saws, and hammers. And there on the shores of Lake Maitland rose stately houses, surrounded by beautiful grounds. Other settlers flocked in from upper New York State, Minnesota, and Michigan, and Maitland became a center of wealth and fashion. In less than 10 years, the plant system, later absorbed into the Atlantic Coastline Railroad, had been persuaded to extend a line south through Maitland, and the private coaches of millionaires and other dignitaries from north and south became a common sight on the siding. Even a president of the United States visited his friends at Maitland. These wealthy homes, glittering carriages behind blooded horses, and occupied by well-dressed folk, presented a curious spectacle in the swampy forests, so dense that they are dark at high noon. The terrain swarmed with the deadly diamondback rattlesnake, most potent reptile on the North American continent. Huge, centuries-old bull alligators bellowed their challenge from the uninhabited shores of lakes. It was necessary to carry a lantern when one walked out at night to avoid stumbling over these immense reptiles in the streets of Maitland. Roads were made by the simple expedient of driving buggies and wagons back and forth over the foot trail, which ran for 7 miles between Maitland and Orlando. The terrain was as flat as a table and totally devoid of rocks. All the roadmakers had to do was to curve around the numerous big pine trees and oaks. It seems it was too much trouble to cut them down. Therefore, the road looked as if it had been laid out by a playful snake. Now and then, somebody would chop down a troublesome tree. Way late, the number of tree stumps along the route began to be annoying. Buggy wheels bumped and jolted over them and took away the pleasure of driving. So a man was hired to improve the road. His instructions were to round off the tops of all stumps so that the wheels, if and when they struck stumps, would slide off gently instead of jolting the teeth out of riders as before. This was done, and the spanking rigs of the Bloods whisked along with more assurance. Now, the Negro population of Maitland settled simultaneously with the white. They had been needed and found profitable employment. The best of relations existed between employer and employee. While the white estates flourished on the 3-mile length of Lake Maitland, the Negroes set up their hastily built shacks around St. John's Hole, a lake as round as a dollar and less than a 1/2 mile wide. It is now a beauty spot in the heart of Maitland, hard by United States Highway Number 17. They call it Lake Lily. The Negro women could be seen every day but Sunday, squatting around St. John's Hole on their haunches, primitive style, washing clothes and fishing, while their men went forth and made their support in cutting new ground, building, and planting orange groves. Things were moving so swiftly that there was plenty to do, with good pay. Other Negroes in Georgia and West Florida heard of the boom in South Florida from Crescent City to Cocoa, and they came. No more backbending over rows of cotton. No more fear of the fury of the Reconstruction. Good pay, sympathetic white folks, and cheap land, soft to the touch of a plow. Relatives and friends were sent for. 2 years after the three adventurers entered the primeval forests of Mosquito County, Maitland had grown big enough and simmered down enough to consider a formal city government. Now, these founders were, to a man, people who had risked their lives and fortunes that Negroes might be free. Those who had fought in the ranks had thrown their weight behind the cause of emancipation. So when it was decided to hold an election, the Eatons, Lawrences, Vanderpools, Hurds, Halls, the Hills, Yateses, and Galloways, and all the rest, including Bishop Whipple, head of the Minnesota diocese, never for a moment considered excluding the Negroes from participation. The whites nominated a candidate, and the Negroes, under the aggressive lead of Joe Clark, a muscular, dynamic Georgia Negro, put up Tony Taylor as their standard bearer. I do not know whether it was the numerical superiority of the Negroes, or whether some of the whites, out of deep feeling, threw their votes to the Negro side. At any rate, Tony Taylor became the first mayor of Maitland, with Joe Clark winning out as town marshal. This was a wholly unexpected turn, but nobody voiced any open objections. The Negro mayor and marshal and the white city council took office peacefully and served their year without incident. But during that year, a yeast was working. Joe Clark had asked himself, why not a Negro town? Few of the Negroes were interested. It was too vaulting for their comprehension. A pure Negro town? If nothing but their own kind was in it, who was going to run it? With no white folks to command them, how would they know what to do? Joe Clark had plenty of confidence in himself to do the job, but few others could conceive of it. But one day, by chance or purpose, Joe Clark was telling of his ambitions to Captain Eaton, who thought it a workable plan. He talked it over with Captain Lawrence and others. By the end of the year, all arrangements had been made. Lawrence and Eaton bought a tract of land a mile west of Maitland for a town site. The backing of the whites helped Joe Clark to convince the other Negroes, and things were settled. Captain Lawrence, at his own expense, erected a well-built church on the new site, and Captain Eaton built a hall for General Assembly and presented it to the new settlement. A little later, the wife of Bishop Whipple had the first church rolled across the street and built a larger church on the same spot, and the first building was to become a library, stocked with books donated by the white community. So on August 18, 1886, the Negro town called Eatonville, after Captain Eaton, received its charter of incorporation from the state capital at Tallahassee, and made history by becoming the first of its kind in America, and perhaps in the world. So in a raw, bustling frontier, the experiment of self-government for Negroes was tried. White Maitland and Negro Eatonville have lived side by side for 55 years without a single instance of enmity. The spirit of the founders has reached beyond the grave. The whole lake country of Florida sprouted with life, mostly northerners, and prosperity was everywhere. It was in the late 80s that the stars fell, and many of the original settlers date their coming just before or just after the stars fell. Chapter 2. My Folks. Into this burly, boiling, hard-hitting, rugged, individualistic setting walked one day a tall, heavy-muscled mulatto who resolved to put down roots. John Hurston, in his late 20s, had left Macon County, Alabama, because the ordeal of sharecropping on a southern Alabama cotton plantation was crushing to his ambition. There was no rise to the thing. He had been born near Notasulga, Alabama, in an outlying district of landless Negroes and whites not too much better off. It was over the creek, which was just like saying on the wrong side of the railroad tracks. John Hurston had learned to read and write somehow between cotton choppings and cotton picking, and it might have satisfied him in a way. But somehow he took to going to Macedonia Baptist Church on the right side of the creek. He went one time and met up with dark brown Lucy Ann Potts of the land-owning Richard Potts, which might have given him the going habit. He was nearly 20 years old then, and she was 14. My mother used to claim with a smile that she saw him looking and looking at her up there in the choir and wondered what he was looking at her for. She wasn't studying about him. However, when the service was over and he kept standing around, never far from her, she asked somebody, "Who is that bee-stung yellow nigger?" "Oh, that's one of them niggers from over the creek, one of them Hurstons. Call him John, I believe." That was supposed to settle that. Over the creek niggers lived from one white man's plantation to the other. Regular hand-to-mouth folks. Didn't own pots to pee in nor beds to push 'em under. Didn't have no more pride than to let themselves be hired by poor white trash. No more to 'em than the stuffings out of a zero. The inference was that Lucy Ann Potts had asked about nothing and had been told. Mama thought no more about him, she said. Of course, she couldn't help noticing that his gray-green eyes and light skin stood out sharply from the black-skinned, black-eyed crowd he was in. Then, too, he had a build on him that made you look. A stud-looking buck like that would have brought a big price in slavery time. Then, if he had not kept on hanging around where she couldn't help from seeing him, she would never have remembered that she had seen him two or three times before, around the cotton gin in Notasulga, and once in a store. She had wondered then who he was, handling bales of cotton like suitcases. After that Sunday, he got right worrisome, slipping her notes between the leaves of hymn books and things like that. It got so bad that a few months later she made up her mind to marry him just to get rid of him. So she did, in spite of the most violent opposition of her family. She put on the little silk dress which she had made with her own hands out of goods bought from egg money she had saved. Her 90 pounds of fortitude set out on her wedding night alone, since none of the family except her brother Jim could bear the sight of her great comedown in the world. She, who was considered the prettiest and the smartest black girl, was throwing herself away and disgracing the Pottses by marrying an over-the-creek nigger, and a bastard at that. Folks said he was a certain white man's son. But here she was, setting out to walk 2 miles at night by herself to keep her pledge to him at the church. Her father, more tolerant than her mother, decided that his daughter was not going alone, nor was she going to walk to her wedding. So he hitched up the buggy and went with her. Nobody much was there. Her brother Jim slipped in just before she stood on the floor. So she said her words and took her stand for life, and went off to a cabin on a plantation with him. She never forgot how the late moon shone that night as his 200 pounds of bone and muscle shoved open the door and lifted her in his arms over the door sill. That cabin on a white man's plantation had to be all for the present. She had been pointedly made to know that the Potts plantation was nothing to her anymore. Her father soon softened and was satisfied to an extent, but her mother, never. To her dying day, her daughter's husband was never John Hurston to her. He was always that yellow bastard. 4 years after my mother's marriage, and during her third pregnancy, she got to thinking of the 5 acres of clingstone peaches on her father's place, and the yearning was so strong that she walked 3 miles to get a few. She was holding the corners of her apron with one hand and picking peaches with the other when her mother spied her and ordered her off the place. It was after his marriage that my father began to want things. Plantation life began to irk and bind him. His over-the-creek existence was finished. What else was there for a man like him? He left his wife and 3 children behind and went out to seek and see. Months later, he pitched into the hurly-burly of South Florida, so he heard about folks building a town all out of colored people. It seemed like a good place to go. Later on, he was to be elected mayor of Eatonville for 3 terms and to write the local laws. The village of Eatonville is still governed by the laws formulated by my father. The town clerk still consults a copy of the original printing, which seems to be the only one in existence now. I have tried every way I know how to get this copy from my library, but so far it has not been possible. I had it once, but the town clerk came and took it back. When my mother joined Papa 1 year after he had settled in Eatonville, she brought some quilts, her feather bed, and bedstead. That was all they had in the house that night. 2 burlap bags were stuffed with Spanish moss for the 2 older children to sleep on. The youngest child was taken into the bed with them. So these 2 began their new life. Both of them swore that things were going to better, and it came to pass as they said. They bought land, built a roomy house, planted their acres, and reaped. Children kept coming, more mouths to feed, and more feet for shoes. But neither of them seemed to have minded that. In fact, my father not only boasted among other men about his house full of youngins, but he boasted that he had never allowed his wife to go out and hit a lick of work for anybody a day in her life. Of weaknesses, he had his share, and I know that my mother was very unhappy at times. But neither of them ever made any move to call the thing off. In fact, on 2 occasions, I heard my father threaten to kill my mother if she ever started towards the gate to leave him. He was outraged and angry one day when she said lightly that if he did not want to do for her and his children, there was another man over the fence waiting for his job. That expression is a folk saying, and Papa had heard it used hundreds of times by other women, but he was outraged at hearing it from Mama. She definitely understood, before he got through carrying on, that the saying was not for her lips. On another occasion, Papa got the idea of escorting the wife of one of his best friends and having the friend escort Mama. But Mama seemed to enjoy it more than Papa thought she ought to, though she had opposed the idea when it was suggested, and it ended up with Papa leaving his friend's wife at the reception and following Mama and his friend home, and marching her into the house with the muzzle of his Winchester rifle in her back. The friend's wife, left alone at the hall, gave both her husband and Papa a good cussing out the next day. Mama dared not laugh even at that, for fear of stirring Papa up more. It was 1 month or so before the 2 families thawed out again. Even after that, the subject could never be mentioned before Papa or the friend's wife, though both of them had been red hot for the experiment. My mother rode herd on one woman with a horse whip about Papa and spoke out another one. This, instead of making Papa angry, seemed to please him ever so much. The woman who got spoken out threatened to whip my mother. Mama was very small, and the other woman was husky. But when Papa heard of the threats against Mama, he notified the outside woman that if she could not whip him too, she had better not bring the mess up. The woman left the county without ever breaking another breath with Papa. Nobody around there knew what became of her. So, looking back, I take it that Papa and Mama, in spite of his meanderings, were really in love. Maybe he was just born before his time. There was nothing then to hinder impulses. They didn't have these zippers on pants in those days, guaranteed to stay locked no matter what the strain. From what I can learn, those button-up flies were mighty tricky and betraying. Maybe if I ask around, somebody will tell me what modern invention has done for a lot of morals. We lived on a big piece of ground with two big chinaberry trees shading the front gate. Cape jasmine bushes with hundreds of blooms on either side of the walks. I loved the fleshy white fragrant blooms as a child, but did not make too much of them. They were too common in my neighborhood. When I got to New York and found out that the people called them gardenias and that the flowers cost a dollar each, I was impressed. The home folks laughed when I went back down there and told them. Some of the folks did not want to believe me. A dollar for a Cape jasmine bloom? Folks up north there must be crazy. There were plenty of orange, grapefruit, tangerine, guavas, and other fruits in our yard. We had a 5-acre garden with things to eat growing in it, and so we were never hungry. We had chicken on the table often, home-cured meat, and all the eggs we wanted. It was a common thing for us smaller children to fill the iron tea kettle full of eggs and boil them, and lay around in the yard and eat them until we were full. Any leftover boiled eggs could always be used for missiles. There was plenty of fish in the lakes around the town, and so we had all that we wanted. But beef stew was something rare. We were all very happy whenever Papa went to Orlando and brought back something delicious like stew beef. Chicken and fish were too common with us. In the same way, we treasured an apple. We had oranges, tangerines, and grapefruit to use as hand grenades on the neighbor's children, but apples were something rare. They came from way up north. Our house had 8 rooms. And we called it a 2-story house, but later on I learned it was really 1-story and a jump. The big boys all slept up there, and it was a good place to hide and shirk from sweeping off the front porch or raking up the backyard. Downstairs in the dining room there was an old safe, a punched design in its 10 doors. Glasses of guava jelly, quart jars of pear, peach, and other kinds of preserves. The leftover cooked foods were on the lower shelves. There were 8 children in the family, and our house was noisy from the time school turned out until bedtime. After supper, we gathered in Mama's room, and everybody had to get their lessons for the next day. Mama carried us all past long division in arithmetic and parsing sentences in grammar by diagrams on the blackboard. That was as far as she had gone. Then the younger ones were turned over to my oldest brother, Bob, and Mama sat and saw to it that we paid attention. You had to keep on going over things until you did know. How I hated the multiplication tables, especially the 7s. We had a big barn and a stretch of ground well covered with Bermuda grass. Soon, moonlight nights, 2/3 of the village children from 7 to 18 would be playing hide-and-whoop, chick-my-chick, hide-and-seek, and other boisterous games in our yard. Once or twice a year, we might get permission to go and play at some other house. But that was most unusual. Mama contended that we had plenty of space to play in, plenty of things to play with, and furthermore, plenty of us to keep each other's company. If she had her way, she meant to raise her children to stay at home. She said that there was no need for us to live like no-count Negroes and poor white trash, too poor to sit in the house, had to come outdoors for any pleasure, or hang around somebody else's house. Any of her children who had any tendencies like that must have got it from the Hurston side. It certainly did not come from the Pottses. Things like that gave me my first glimmering of the universal female gospel that all good traits and leanings come from the mother's side. Mama exhorted her children at every opportunity to jump at the sun. We might not land on the sun, but at least we would get off the ground. Papa did not feel so hopeful. Let well enough alone. It did not do for Negroes to have too much spirit. He was always threatening to break mine or kill me in the attempt. My mother was always standing between us. She conceded that I was impudent and given to talking back, but she didn't want to squinch my spirit too much for fear that I would turn out to be a mealy-mouthed rag doll by the time I got grown. Papa always flew hot when Mama said that. I do not know whether he feared for my future with the tendency I had to stand and give battle, or that he felt a personal reference in Mama's observation. He predicted dire things for me. The white folks were not going to stand for it. I was going to be hung before I got grown. Somebody was going to blow me down for my sassy tongue. Mama was going to suck sorrow for not beating my temper out of me before it was too late. Posses with ropes and guns were going to drag me out sooner or later on account of that stiff neck I toted. I was going to tote a hungry belly by reason of my forward ways. My older sister was meek and mild. She would always get along. Why couldn't I be like her? Mama would keep right on with whatever she was doing and remark, "Zora is my youngin', and Sarah is yours. I'll be bound mine will come out more than conquer. You leave her alone. I'll tend to her when I figure she needs it." She meant by that Sarah had a disposition like Papa's, while mine was like hers. Behind Mama's rocking chair was a good place to be in times like that. Papa was not going to hit Mama. He was 200 pounds of bone and muscle, and Mama weighed somewhere in the 90s. When people teased him about Mama being the boss, he would say he could break her of her headstrong ways if he wanted to, but she was so little that he couldn't find any place to hit her. My Uncle Jim, Mama's brother, used to always take exception to that. He maintained that if a woman had anything big enough to sit on, she had something big enough to hit on. That was his firm conviction, and he meant to hold on to it as long as the bottom end of his backbone pointed towards the ground. Don't care who the woman was or what she looked like or where she came from. Men like Papa who held to any other notion were just beating around the bush, dodging the issue and otherwise looking like a fool at a funeral. Papa used to shake his head at this and say, "What's the use of me taking my fist to a poor weakly thing like a woman? Anyhow, you gotta submit yourself to 'em, so there ain't no use in beating on 'em and then have to go back and beg 'em pardon." But perhaps the real reason that Papa did not take Uncle Jim's advice too seriously was because he saw how it worked out in Uncle Jim's own house. He could tackle Aunt Caroline, all right, but he had his hands full to really beat her. A knockdown didn't convince her that the fight was over at all. She would get up and come right on in, and she was nobody's weakling. It was generally conceded that he might get the edge on her in physical combat if he took a hammer or a trace chain to her, but in other ways, she always won. She would watch his various philandering episodes just so long, and then she would go into action. One time she saw all and said nothing. But one Saturday afternoon, she watched him rush in with a new shoebox, which he thought that she did not see him take out to the barn and hide until he was ready to go out. Just as the sun went down, he went out, got his box, cut across the orange grove, and went on down to the store. He stopped long enough there to buy a quart of peanuts, 2 stalks of sugar cane, and then tripped on off to the little house in the woods where lived a certain transient light of love. Aunt Caroline kept right on ironing until he had gotten as far as the store. Then she slipped on her shoes, went out in the yard and got the axe, slung it across her shoulder, and went walking very slowly behind him. The men on the store porch had given Uncle Jim a laughing send-off. They all knew where he was going and why. The shoes had been bought right there at the store. Now here came that Caroline with her axe on her shoulder. No chance to warn Uncle Jim at all. Nobody expected murder, but they knew that plenty of trouble was on the way. So they just sat and waited. Caroline had done so many side-splitting things to Jim's lights of love, all without a single comment from her, that they were on pins to see what happened next. About an hour later, when it was almost black dark, they saw a furtive figure in white dodging from tree to tree until it hopped over Clark's strawberry patch fence and headed towards Uncle Jim's house until it disappeared. "Looked mightily like a man in long drawers and nothing else," Walter Thomas observed. Everybody agreed that it did, but who and what could it be? By the time the town lamp, which stood in front of the store, was lighted, Aunt Caroline emerged from the blackness that hid the woods and passed the store. The axe was still over her shoulder, but now it was draped with Uncle Jim's pants, shirt, and coat. A new pair of women's oxfords were dangling from the handle by their strings. 2 stalks of sugar cane were over her other shoulder. All she said was, "Good evening, gentlemen," and kept right on walking towards home. The porch rocked with laughter. They had the answer to everything. Later on, when they asked Uncle Jim how Caroline managed to get into the lady's house, he smiled sourly and said, "That axe was her key." When they kept on teasing him, he said, "Oh, that old stubborn woman I married, you can't teach her nothing. I can't teach her no city ways at all." On another occasion, she caused another lady who couldn't give the community anything but love, baby, to fall off the high, steep church steps on her head. Aunt Caroline might have done that just to satisfy her curiosity, since it was said that the lady felt that anything more than a petticoat under her dresses would be an encumbrance. Maybe Aunt Caroline just wanted to verify the rumor. The way the lady tumbled, it left no doubt in the matter. She was really a free soul. Evidently, Aunt Caroline was put out about it because she had to expectorate at that very moment, and it just happened to land where the lady was bare. Aunt Caroline evidently tried to correct her error in spitting on her rival, for she took her foot and tried to grind it in. She never said a word, as usual, so the lady must have misunderstood Aunt Caroline's curiosity. She left town in a hurry, a speedy hurry, and never was seen in those parts again. So Papa did not take Uncle Jim's philosophy about handling the lady people too seriously. Every time Mama cornered him about some of his doings, he used to threaten to wring a chair over her head. She never even took enough notice of the threat to answer. She just went right on asking questions about his doings and then answering them herself until Papa slammed out of the house looking like he had been whipped all over with peach hickories. But I had better not let out a giggle at such times, or it would be just too bad. Our house was a place where people came. Visiting preachers, Sunday school and BYPU workers, and just friends. There was fried chicken for visitors and other such hospitality as the house afforded. Papa's bedroom was the guest room. Store-bought towels would be taken out of the old round-topped trunk in Mama's room and draped on the washstand. The pitcher and bowl were scrubbed out before fresh water from the pump was put in there for the use of the guest. Sweet soap was company soap. We knew that. Otherwise, Octagon laundry soap was used to keep us clean. Bleached-out meal sacks served the family for bath towels ordinarily, so that the store-bought towels could be nice and clean for visitors. Company got the preference in toilet paper, too. Old newspapers were put out in the privy house for family use, but when company came, something better was offered them. Fair to middling guests got sheets out of the old Sears Roebuck catalog, but Mama would sort over her old dress patterns when really fine company came, and the privy house was well scrubbed, lime thrown in, and the soft tissue paper pattern stuck on a nail inside the place for the comfort and pleasure of our guests. It was not that regular toilet paper was unheard of in our house. It was just unthought of. It was right there in the catalog for us to see. But as long as we had Mr. Sears Roebuck's catalog, we had no need for his toilet paper. Chapter 3. I Get Born. This is all hearsay. Maybe some of the details of my birth, as told me, might be a little inaccurate. But it is pretty well established that I really did get born. The saying goes like this. My mother's time had come and my father was not there. Being a carpenter, successful enough to have other helpers on some jobs, he was away often on building business, as well as preaching. It seems that my father was away from home for months this time. I have never been told why. But I did hear that he threatened to cut his throat when he got the news. It seems that one daughter was all that he figured he could stand. My sister Sarah was his favorite child, but that one girl was enough. Plenty more sons, but no more girl babies to wear out shoes and bring in nothing. I don't think he ever got over the trick he felt that I played on him by getting born a girl, and while he was off from home at that, a little of my sugar used to sweeten his coffee right now. That is a Negro way of saying his patience was short with me. Let me change a few words with him, and I am of the word-changing kind, and he was ready to change ends. Still in all, I looked more like him than any child in the house. Of course, by the time I got born, it was too late to make any suggestions, so the old man had to put up with me. He was nice about it, in a way. He didn't tie me in a sack and drop me in the lake, as he probably felt like doing. People were digging sweet potatoes, and then it was hog-killing time. Not at our house, but it was going on in general over the country, like being January and a bit cool. Most people were either butchering for themselves or off helping other folks do their butchering, which was almost just as good. It is a gay time. A big pot of haslets cooking with plenty of seasoning, lean slabs of fresh-killed pork frying for the helpers to refresh themselves after the work is done. Over and above being neighborly and giving aid, there is the food, the drinks, and the fun of getting together. So there was no grown folks close around when Mama's water broke. She sent one of the smaller children to fetch Aunt Judy, the midwife, but she was gone to Woodbridge, a mile and a half away, to eat at a hog killing. The child was told to go over there and tell Aunt Judy to come. But nature, being indifferent to human arrangements, was impatient. My mother had to make it alone. She was too weak after I rushed out to do anything for herself, so she just was lying there, sick in the body and worried in mind, wondering what would become of her as well as me. She was so weak she couldn't even reach down to where I was. She had one consolation. She knew I wasn't dead because I was crying strong. Help came from where she never would have thought to look for it. A white man of many acres and things who knew the family well had butchered the day before. Knowing that Papa was not at home, and that consequently there would be no fresh meat in our house, he decided to drive the 5 miles and bring a half of a shoat, sweet potatoes, and other garden stuff along. He was there a few minutes after I was born. Seeing the front door standing open, he came on in and hollered, "Hello there! Call your dogs!" That is the regular way to call in the country because nearly everybody who has anything to watch has biting dogs. Nobody answered, but he claimed later that he heard me spreading my lungs all over Orange County, so he shoved the door open and bolted on into the house. He followed the noise, and then he saw how things were, and being the kind of a man he was, he took out his Barlow knife and cut the navel cord. Then he did the best he could about other things. When the midwife, locally known as a granny, arrived about an hour later, there was a fire in the stove and plenty of hot water on. I had been sponged off in some sort of a way, and Mama was holding me in her arms. As soon as the old woman got there, the white man unloaded what he had brought and drove off, cussing about some blankety-blank people never being where you could put your hands on them when they were needed. He got no thanks from Aunt Judy. She grumbled for years about it. She complained that the cord had not been cut just right, and the belly band had not been put on tight enough. She was mighty scared I was going to have a weak back, and that I would have trouble holding my water until I reached puberty. I did. The next day or so, a Mrs. Neal, a friend of Mama's, came in and reminded her that she had promised to let her name the baby in case it was a girl. She had picked up a name somewhere which she thought was very pretty. Perhaps she had read it somewhere, or somebody back in those woods was smoking Turkish cigarettes. So I became Zora Neale Hurston. There is nothing to make you like other human beings so much as doing things for them. Therefore, the man who grannied me was back next day to see how I was coming along. Maybe it was pride in his own handiwork and his resourcefulness in a pinch that made him want to see it through. He remarked that I was a goddamn fine baby. Fat and plenty of lung power. As time went on, he came infrequently, but somehow kept a pinch of interest in my welfare. It seemed that I was spying noble, growing like a gourd vine, and yelling bass like a gator. He was the kind of a man that had no use for puny things, so I was all to the good with him. He thought my mother was justified in keeping me. But 9 months rolled around and I just would not get on with the walking business. I was strong, crawling well, but showed no inclination to use my feet. I might remark in passing that I still don't like to walk. Then I was over a year old, but still I would not walk. They made allowances for my weight, but yet that was no real reason for my not trying. They tell me that an old sow hog taught me how to walk. That is, she didn't instruct me in detail, but she convinced me that I really ought to try. It was like this. My mother was going to have collard greens for dinner, so she took the dishpan and went down to the spring to wash the greens. She left me sitting on the floor and gave me a hunk of cornbread to keep me quiet. Everything was going along all right. Until the sow, with her litter of pigs in convoy, came abreast of the door. She must have smelled the cornbread I was messing with and scattering crumbs about the floor, so she came right on in and began to nuzzle around. My mother heard my screams and came running. Her heart must have stood still when she saw the sow in there, because hogs have been known to eat human flesh. But I was not taking this thing sitting down. I had been placed by a chair. And when my mother got inside the door, I had pulled myself up by that chair and was getting around it right smart. As for the sow, poor misunderstood lady, she had no interest in me except my bread. I lost that in scrambling to my feet and she was eating it. She had much less intention of eating Mama's baby than Mama had of eating hers. With no more suggestions from the sow or anybody else, it seems that I just took to walking and kept the thing a-going. The strangest thing about it was that once I found the use of my feet, they took to wandering. I always wanted to go. I would wander off in the woods all alone, following some inside urge to go places. This alarmed my mother a great deal. She used to say that she believed a woman who was an enemy of hers had sprinkled travel dust around the doorstep the day I was born. That was the only explanation she could find. I don't know why it never occurred to her to connect my tendency with my father, who didn't have a thing on his mind but this town and the next one. That should have given her a sort of hint. Some children are just bound to take after their fathers, in spite of women's prayers. Chapter 4. The Inside Search. Grown people know that they do not always know the why of things, and even if they think they know, they do not know where and how they got the proof. Hence the irritation they show when children keep on demanding to know if a thing is so and how the grown folks got the proof of it. It is so troublesome because it is disturbing to the pigeonhole way of life. It is upsetting because until the elders are pushed for an answer, they have never looked to see if it was so, nor how they came by what passes for proof to their acceptances of certain things as true. So if telling their questioning young to run off and play does not suffice for an answer, a good slapping of the child's bottom is held to be proof positive for anything from spelling Constantinople to why the sea is salt. It was told to the old folks and that had been enough for them, or to put it in the Negro idiom, nobody didn't tell them but they heard. So there must be something wrong with a child that questions the gods of the pigeonholes. I was always asking and making myself a crow in a pigeon's nest. It was hard on my family and surroundings, and they in turn were hard on me. I did not know then, as I know now, that people are prone to build a statue of the kind of person that it pleases them to be. And few people want to be forced to ask themselves, what if there is no me like my statue? The thing to do is to grab the broom of anger and drive off the beast of fear. I was full of curiosity like many other children, and like them I was as unconscious of the sanctity of statuary as a flock of pigeons around a palace. I got few answers from other people, but I kept right on asking, because I couldn't do anything else with my feelings. Naturally, I felt like other children in that death, destruction, and other agonies were never meant to touch me. Things like that happened to other people, and no wonder. They were not like me and mine. Naturally, the world and the firmaments careened to one side a little so as not to inconvenience me. In fact, the universe went further than that. It was happy to break a few rules just to show me preferences. For instance, for a long time I gloated over the happy secret that when I played outdoors in the moonlight, the moon followed me, whichever way I ran. The moon was so happy when I came out to play that it ran shining and shouting after me like a pretty puppy dog. The other children didn't count. But I was rudely shaken out of this when I confided my happy secret to Carrie Roberts, my chum. It was cruel. She not only scorned my claim, she said that the moon was paying me no mind at all, The moon, my own happy private playing moon, was out in its play yard to race and play with her. We disputed the matter with hot jealousy, and nothing would do but we must run a race to prove which one the moon was loving. First, we both ran a race side by side, but that proved nothing because we both contended that the moon was going that way on account of us. I just knew that the moon was there to be with me, but Carrie kept on saying that it was herself that the moon preferred. So then it came to me that we ought to run in opposite directions, so that Carrie could come to her senses and realize the moon was mine. So we both stood with our backs to our gate, counted three, and tore out in opposite directions. "Look, look, Carrie," I cried exultantly. "You see, the moon is following me." "Aw, you's a tale teller. You know it's chasing me." So Carrie and I parted company, mad as we could be with each other. When the other children found out what the quarrel was about, they laughed it off. They told me the moon always followed them. The unfaithfulness of the moon hurt me deeply. My moon followed Carrie Roberts. My moon followed Matilda Clark and Julia Mosley and Oscar and T.D. Miller. But after a while, I ceased to ache over the moon's many loves. I found comfort in the fact that though I was not the moon's exclusive friend, I was still among those who showed the moon which way to go. That was my earliest conscious hint that the world didn't tilt under my footfalls, nor careen over one-sided just to make me glad. But no matter whether my probings made me happier or sadder, I kept on probing to know. For instance, I had a stifled longing. I used to climb to the top of one of the huge chinaberry trees which guarded our front gate and look out over the world. The most interesting thing that I saw was the horizon. Every way I turned, it was there, and the same distance away. Our house, then, was in the center of the world. It grew upon me that I ought to walk out to the horizon and see what the end of the world was like. The daring of the thing held me back for a while, but the thing became so urgent that I showed it to my friend, Carrie Roberts, and asked her to go with me. She agreed. We sat up in the trees and disputed about what the end of the world would be like when we got there, whether it was sort of tucked under like the hem of a dress or just was a sharp drop-off into nothingness. So we planned to slip off from our folks bright and soon next morning and go see. I could hardly sleep that night from the excitement of the thing. I had been yearning for so many months to find out about the end of things. I had no doubts about the beginnings. They were somewhere in the 5 acres that was home to me, most likely in Mama's room. Now I was going to see the end, and then I would be satisfied. As soon as breakfast was over, I sneaked off to the meeting place in the scrub palmettos, a short way from our house, and waited. Carrie didn't come right away. I was on my way to her house by a roundabout way when I met her. She was coming to tell me that she couldn't go. It looked so far that maybe we wouldn't get back by sundown, and then we would both get a whipping. When we got big enough to wear long dresses, we could go and stay as long as we wanted to. Nobody couldn't whip us then. No matter how hard I begged, she wouldn't go. The thing was too bold and brazen to her thinking. We had a fight then. I had to hit Carrie to keep my heart from stifling me. Then I was sorry I had struck my friend and went on home and hid under the house with my heartbreak. But I did not give up the idea of my journey. I was merely lonesome for someone brave enough to undertake it with me. I wanted it to be Carrie. She was a lot of fun and always did what I told her. Well, most of the time she did. This time it was too much for even her loyalty to surmount. She even tried to talk me out of my trip. I couldn't give up. It meant too much to me. I decided to put it off until I had something to ride on. Then I could go by myself. So for weeks, I saw myself sitting astride of a fine